Well, a very good evening to you all. You're listening to Dr. Rock's radio show on TNSradio.com. That's TNSR Radio, Land of the Free. It's taken me, as usual, some 30 minutes or so to master the technology and actually get it so that I can bring you voice as well as music. I'm sorry it's taken a bit of time. I'm sure in the end I'll get the hang of this game. The very contents of this evening's show are still sort of somewhat in the balance. I'm hoping to bring you... Jonathan Adams, who's a writer, filmmaker and broadcaster, with whom I've had a chance to work on occasion, and I've seen much of his stuff on YouTube, and I believe he wants to come on to discuss partly what's going on in the rest of the world with regards to kind of rebellion and resistance. And I know he also wants to talk about a court of public record that is being set up on the internet by the White Rabbit Group. I also hope that maybe later on the Spaniard, who we were talking to last week in a bit of a podcast, might be able to join us as well. So there's plenty of room for more chaos there. I know that Jonathan himself is having trouble with his microphone. So what I'm going to do is play another tune, try and phone Jonathan and see if I can hear him. And if I can, I'll bring him to you. If not, I'll tell you what I'm going to do next. Very good. You're back live with Dr. Rock's radio show on TNSradio.com. Well, it appears that Jonathan is indeed having a little bit of trouble getting the tackle working at his end, so I was hoping to divide the show into kind of two halves, as I quite often do anyway. So what I'm going to do instead is to take the pressure off it at this end a little bit. I'm going to introduce you to a walk that was done about 2 or 3 years ago now by a group of people. And it's connected with things that the Dr. Rock radio show has covered before, because it's connected with the Michael and Mary lines that run from Cornwall to, I think, Hopton in East Anglia. We've spoken about a famous dowser called Hamish Miller on the programme, I know, at least a couple of times before. And he was very much the man who investigated these lines. And he wrote a book about the experience. He wrote a book about how all of that was done and how the mapping was done, and it was called The Sun and the Serpent, and it's a very impressive book and has inspired an enormous number of people over time. Eventually, there's a man called Graham who's got a bit of a history of long walks, and I think we'll be hearing more of him as time goes by. I'd like to get him onto the programme. And he decided that he'd like to get a group of people together to walk this line from between Beltane and the summer solstice, so they had something like 50 odd days, I think it was, to walk 500 miles. And they had a couple of vehicles with them, and they kind of camped as they went along, and Graham had been along and met several people and set up the basic campsites, but still it was a pretty much make it up as you go along gig. And I'm aware that these people are out walking again at the moment, which is really great. They're starting a new walk today from along the River Waveney over the next couple of weeks, so it's not quite such an ambitious thing. But what these people are doing is they're effectively getting an intentional community together. They're people who haven't necessarily met each other before, some of them had, and they're effectively going to meet down in Cornwall, watch the sunrise, and then one way or the other they're going to make the way across the country together, making it work, pulling off quite a complicated mission in the process. And really, the job speaks for itself. I'm speaking with a lady who likes to be known as Synchro, who was on the whole of the walk and is indeed out walking the new walk now. We hear a bit about the project planning. I'm going to divide. I spoke with her for sort of an hour and a half on the subject, and she kind of in the first 45 minutes introduces some of the ideas for the walk and all that kind of thing. So it makes a good time to split it. So what I'll probably do is play that and maybe have a chat about it, have a go at getting Jonathan whilst that is going on, so that we can hopefully bring you the court of record material later on in the programme. I've got a kind of personal interest in the Sun and Serpent and the Michael and Mary lines really as well, because on the day that this walk, Awakening Albion it was called, the walk, and on the day it started in Beltane 2008, I was in Glastonbury, and I was doing a weekend of ceremonial work with some ancestral shamans from the Maya lands and from North and South America, and we were endeavouring to weave together the spirit of the land of Albion with the lands of the Eagle and the Condor and the Quetzal. And the name of the body with which I was working to do this work on the Beltane that last walk started was the Sun and the Serpent Mystery School, and they too, of course, had been inspired by Hamish's book. So Synchro and I very much felt that we were kind of working at two ends of the same project there, and I think with that I can hopefully give you sort of 40 minutes or so of my chat with her, and you can hear how it went with them. And then, like I say, I'll come back and we'll see how it goes from there. So here we are then, Synchro. Your great adventure happened in 2008. It's now 2011, so it's taken us a mere 3 years to finally settle down and do a bit of a debrief, find out what it was like and how it impressed you. So where do you think we should start with a look at the Awakening Albion project?
Well, I think we should start with inspiration, because the whole walk was inspired. We were inspired by Hamish Miller and his story of the Sun and the Serpent.
And we have, of course, spoken about Hamish Miller on the Dr. Rock radio show a couple
already.
Of times before, yes.
Hamish Miller and Paul Broadhurst, who wrote the wonderful book, The Sun and the Serpent, were in their turn inspired by John Michel.
One of my personal favourites, John Michel.
And John Michel was inspired by many people to go to Glastonbury when he first recognised that there was a line that actually extended all the way across the country from Cornwall to Norfolk and had many, many sacred sites, tumps and churches along the way.
This is an energy line such as the ones Mark Foster was talking with us about a couple of weeks ago, is it?
Well, the actual line, the straight line that runs from a point in Cornwall to a point on the Norfolk coast, is what you might call a ley line. The Michael and Mary lines, which weave their way around that straight alignment, are what you might call all sorts of things, but they've been called dragon lines, earth energy lines, Michael Mary lines, all sorts of things.
But one of the ways of identifying their presence is with dowsing rods.
That's right.
Okay,
that's
and right. So the straight line you're talking to is like an average of these two different energy lines.
Yeah, it's a very straight line. It actually marks the line of the sunrise at Beltane viewed from that point in Cornwall.
Mm-hmm.
We viewed that at the very beginning of the walk.
So from the line runs from the sunrise in Cornwall to Beltane, the Beltane sunrise in Cornwall to the summer solstice sunrise at...
Well, no, the line is actually of the Beltane sunrise.
Okay.
I believe that to be the case. When we... To go to the beginning of the walk, we all met in Cornwall in May the 5th, I think it was, 2008.
Which is the proper Beltane, not May the 1st. Yes.
And that's when we met the wonderful organisers of the walk, Graham Joyce and Lynn Merriland. What a wonderful name. And these two people had put a lot of work into organising the walk. They had driven from Cornwall all the way along that alignment to the sea at Hopton in Norfolk, and they had organised the walks themselves, not actually walked all of the walk, but visited many of the sites along the walk, and checked the footpaths to see that they were open with the councils along the way. An enormous amount of work was put in by Graham, poring over maps, ringing councils, setting up the campsites. They visited every single campsite. It was a 50-day walk, so there were about 40-odd campsites, because we did have some rest days along the way. But basically, 50 days of walking took us from Carnless Boyle, just south of Land's End in Cornwall, all the way to Hopton-on-Sea on the Norfolk coast, and it took us 50 days.
And it's some 550 miles.
Yeah, it's over 500 miles. And we started very, very early, way before dawn, on Beltane, May the 5th, in Cornwall. We set off in the dark to walk to Carnless Boyle, which is this fantastic rocky headland sticking out into the wild Atlantic Sea, I believe it is there. It was pretty wild anyway. And we met there in the dusk of dawn and waited for the sunrise. And lo and behold, it rose.
And that was the starting. That was the starting gun for your mission, wasn't
that
it?
Was really? The very
that sunrise
beginning.
Was the very beginning. Lovely.
And we had a plan that we were going to light a fire from the Beltane sunrise, create a flame that we had this pretty crazy idea, really, that we were going to carry this flame with us all the way to Norfolk.
Major health and safety issue, carrying fire the full length of the country.
The practicalities of that. I think it lasted, the flame lasted about 5 days.
It's interesting that, isn't it? Because, of course, you know how our ancestors used to carry fire around, don't you?
And yeah.
That might have been more successful.
They used to carry smouldering pieces of fungus in horns and blow on them occasionally to keep them alive.
Yeah.
And at the end of the day, then, they would tip it out and use a bit of kindling to get it going again.
Yeah.
What we were trying to do was far more ambitious, really. We were trying to carry this flame using paraffin lamps and candles and along the way. Like I say, it lasted about 5 days.
I bet there were some people in the group, were there, who were more reluctant to let it go than others? Or was everybody had enough of it by the end of day 5?
We realised that it was practically pretty impossible, really. We all decided and we all agreed that we would carry our inner flame with us on the way rather than trying to take this physical flame. But the great thing about this flame, and I was kind of, really? Can we really do this? Because what we did was Graham Joyce, one of the organisers, he had this fantastic ball of rock crystal in his bag, which he pulled out as the sun rose, and we used the crystal to light a fire from which we took this flame with the light of the sunrise. And I was amazed that it was strong enough to do that.
Still the sun, isn't it?
It's the sun, which of course is the sun.
If you focus it.
You know, but I was thinking perhaps you had to use the midday sun or,
yes,
you know, something,
yeah,
like that. But this was, the sun had just risen. Yeah. And we were...
a fire with the Beltane sunrise.
We did.
Isn't that fantastic?
Yeah, it was fantastic.
A good way to start.
Yeah, and we had flasks of tea and a few people turned up, actually, who weren't anything to do with the walk. A few people turned up to sing songs.
I love the way people do that.
Yeah.
I love the way people want to come and join in. It really, really, really chirps you up, doesn't,
yeah,
it?
This lovely man called Ian, I can't for the moment remember his second name, but a lovely man called Ian met us at the beginning of the walk with his guitar. Before dawn, he knew we were going to be there, and he'd arranged especially to come and meet us there. So there were songs, there were a group of people, some of whom had never met before, on this rocky headland at dawn.
That's what you were going to do. You were going to sing and dance your way across the country, were,
yeah,
you not?
There was a lot of singing and dancing on the way, for sure. That's something we did a lot of along the way. Not all the time, because there was a lot of serious walking to be done as well, but there was...
What was the biggest distance you sort of covered in a day?
Well, we must have walked... I think there must have been a few 17, 18-mile days.
Mm.
And, of course, if you get lost and have to find your way back to the route again, which did also happen, there must have been a few 20-mile days.
And then some, perhaps.
And then some, perhaps. So there was... Yeah, the walking was pretty arduous.
So what about the inspiration then?
Well,
John Michel, what was it that inspired Graham, do you think? He was in...
Well, Graham was also inspired by John Michel, but he had organised... Well, not organised, but he had been a part of another walk, a fantastic-sounding walk that happened in 1983. He took part in a walk called A Walk for Life, which was an 11-week journey from Faslane near Glasgow to Greenham Common near Newbury, both being military bases with nuclear weapons at the time.
I remember them well. They were famous at the time. I'm not sure what's in those places now.
And the experience of being a part of that walk had left Graham with a sense that he really wanted to do another long walk in Britain across a vast part of our country with a group of people walking as a community, which is what the Walk for Life had been. It was a kind of a rolling community of people walking intentionally across our land.
And community is, of course, one of our special interests here on the Dr. Rock Radio Show. The fostering of community is something that I'm extremely keen to help in any way. And one of the things that fascinates me about the Awakening Albion project is this idea that a bundle of people meet at one end of the country and they don't know each other from Adam, maybe being a bit of email contact in between, but they are going to have to take, and whatever the food is that's cooked, they're going to have to take the digging of the pits in the field for, you know, whatever needs to be done, and they're going to have to put up with each other for the next 50 days, irrespective of what happens, and one way or the other, they're going to have to make it happen.
Yeah.
Community in action. I'm really interested. How did it go as a...
Well, at the beginning, there were a few people as a part of the walk. I think we must have been about 20-odd people at the very beginning, and we met at this campsite in Cornwall. There was a fair amount of the group did know each other already, because they were part of Graham's friends and acquaintances from Norfolk and Suffolk.
So there's a sort of core group there.
Was a core group of people who had been involved with Graham in other projects,
yeah,
such as the Dance Camp East that Graham's been instrumental in for many years. So he had some people with him who knew him and were there partly because of him and also because of the inspiration for the walk. But there were some people there, like myself, who'd never met a single one of these people before. There were a few of us. And for us, I mean, we were broaching something, we were beginning something. We had absolutely, well, none of us really had any idea how this was going to go. And at first, when we first, the first day we set off from this campsite in Cornwall, we were given maps. Some of us had our own maps. We were told exactly where the first campsite was going to be. We had it marked on the maps. We had Hamish Miller's maps, copies of Hamish Miller's maps with us.
The maps that Hamish used when he was dowsing the Michael and Mary lines?
Yeah.
Oh, that's the original inspiration. Oh, yeah. You were working from the original documents.
We were. We were working from Hamish's maps as well as OS maps.
Yeah.
But that first day, to be honest, was a bit of a shambles, really, because we'd never worked together before, we'd never walked together before, a lot of us didn't know each other, and the footpaths in that part of Cornwall, they're not used very much. So most people, when they go walking around that part of Cornwall, I think, use the lanes. But we were trying to find these footpaths.
You're trying to stay off the lanes as far as possible.
We were trying to stay off tarmac as much
as
possible. The whole walk tried to stay off tarmac as much as possible. So we were entering these farmers' fields with a sign, you know, sometimes a sign and sometimes just an old stone stile which was marking the entrance to the footpath. And then you'd get into the field and there would be no sign as to where you were meant to be going.
I have been walking with you many times and I know that many lines, many paths that are marked well on maps are not necessarily marked that clearly on the ground.
And in that part of Cornwall, some people will know that the stone walls sometimes are absolutely massive, 10 feet high and more, these massive banks of stone.
Those must be old walls.
Yeah, I think they must be pretty ancient. And the stiles, of course, were built into these walls.
Okay.
So the stiles were also 10, 12 feet high,
yeah,
with little steps in the walls so that you could get over these
stones,
things.
Isn't it?
Yeah, I don't know what the stone is, but they're, you know, massive walls to be crossing. So we were crossing tens of these walls in the first day. We did get lost. We got lost on that first day. There was a bit of champing at the bit, you know, some people thinking they knew which way to go, and other people, we had a bit of a split, you know, some people went one way, some people went another way. But we finally arrived at the first campsite, which I think is where we had the great honour of being visited by Hamish Miller and his wife Bar.
Marvellous.
They came to our second campsite.
Must have been great for Hamish, because of course he was really the sort of spring, wasn't he? He's the wellspring of the entire project.
Totally. And we had a whole evening with them. We were very honoured because they had been working all day Hamish was no spring chicken. At that time, he must have been about... he was in his 80s anyway. And they'd been working all day with what they described as quite a tiring group and had still come to spend the evening with us. And we sat...
He lived locally, didn't he?
He lived fairly near to that first campsite. In fact, he'd been part of a project at that first campsite of placing a standing stone in the centre of the field there and had been dowsing to gauge how the energy lines around the stone had changed since it had been there. Mm-hmm. That's something that Hamish was very interested in and did a lot of work on.
Just to remind people, I've spoken before about the fact that I've seen Hamish on a video using dowsing rods to douse energy lines in a stone circle, and the technical team put electrodes onto Hamish's head and then using a computer screen, and you could see quite definitely that Hamish's entire brain worked differently as he slipped into his dowsing mode.
Yeah.
The methods he used to douse energy lines meant that he was, as Mark Foster put it, tuning into the world beyond the five senses, and scientific equipment picks up that, it can see it happening. So,
well, in a way, I mean, Hamish, I think, with the work he did, he was communicating with the Earth. That's my understanding of what he was doing.
And she was really willing to communicate with him once
totally,
he opened.
Yeah. Totally. And by placing a standing stone in the middle of this field where there had not been a standing stone before, he changed the energy patterns in that field. And he had to pop off with his dowsing rods that night to gauge again how they had changed since he'd last been there. He was very excited by it. He's a fantastic man, very charming man. Anyway, we sat around the fire that night. We had a big group, must have been about 25, 30 people there, because the people who owned the land were there with us as well, and very interested in the project. Hamish and Barr joined us, and we went around every single person around that fire that night, and everybody told their story as to why they were there.
And that's kind of, so you've sort of founded the community after a day's walking.
Yeah.
Kind of.
Really.
And having Hamish there must have been a great way of grounding it and not letting it maybe get a little bit too feisty.
Yeah.
How did it go as a first meeting with Hamish there?
Fantastic, because it was a really centering experience, I think, for everybody involved in the walk. We felt really honoured to have him and his wife there. And apparently he was really honoured by the fact that we were doing the walk. And he was moved nearly to tears that evening, because as we went around the fire and everybody told their stories, every single one of us mentioned Hamish and his work and the fantastic book he wrote, I think I've already mentioned, called The Sun and the Serpent by Paul Broadhurst and Hamish Miller.
Of course, I can add my 10 penneth there, because both you and I have been working with the Sun and Serpent Mystery School over various Maya festivals and things
we've
done, and they too, we've been working with them for 15 years, haven't we, and they got their name from Hamish's book.
The naming of the Sun and Serpent Mystery School was inspired by the work and the book called The Sun and the Serpent.
So it was in your life for maybe a decade before you even came to do the walk, the awakening. And also, I know that Graham's a very gentle, and he's not a manager of people. He likes to let things unfold themselves, doesn't he?
He's a very good, he's a very skilled holder of the space for the group. You can sit in a circle with Graham as a part of that circle, and there will be a holding, if you know what I mean, of the energy of the group. It's a very special skill.
Extremely necessary, I would have thought, over the first few days and nights of the walk, perhaps.
Most definitely.
And that, what we're talking about here, is the ability to hold a space without saying anything.
Yeah.
Or saying, not necessarily without saying anything, but saying only what is necessary, and only when it's necessary to say it, and otherwise letting the group find its own bounds.
Yeah.
Not imposing himself.
That's right. I mean, we had the idea that we would hold a council every night on the walk, but it soon became apparent that there were so many practicalities to be dealt with that really wasn't possible. Not everybody had the inclination and the focus or the energy at the end of a long walking day to sit in council with the patience needed to listen to everybody.
Now, doesn't that make an interesting point in this day, in this world where we're expected to record and write down, and nearly everything that we do is one way or other registered, recorded or stamped? And there you were, because I know you were planning on having quite a lot of fun in the evenings, weren't you? But actually it turned out that simply being the community that you were, doing the mission that you were doing, was what you had to put. There was no level of management enabled because you were too shattered.
Well, it's right, because there was actually a lot of work, and the fantastic thing about what Graham and Lynn had set up is that we were our own crew for the walk. There were no staff as such. Well, there were no staff at all. Everybody who took part in the walk crewed the walk. So we did the driving of the vehicles. There were two vehicles that accompanied us on the walk so that we wouldn't have to be carrying our big bags and stuff. So we took turns to do the driving, the shopping, the cooking. And quite often, Graham was very keen when he set up the walk to actually not use any proper campsites at all with facilities. He wanted to use farmers' fields, which is mostly what we did. So we were digging a fire pit, cutting the turf away so that we could have a proper fire and put the turf back in the morning to leave it as we'd found it, more or less. We were digging pits to use as latrines every night. So you had to gauge how many people you were that day and dig an appropriately sized pit for the people to ablute evening and morning, or however often they would need to do it. And then that of course had to be filled in the morning and made good again. There were two vehicles on the walk. One was a wonderful old van, is it not an LED van? What are they called, those vans?
LDV.
LDV. Not LED. LDV. And it was a grey van owned by this wonderful character called Alex, Wildfireman Alex. And it was grey, and he had called this van Albion before he'd got involved in the walk.
There were lots of Albion synchronicities in the setup.
Many synchronicities led to this.
Graham's tale was, yeah.
Yeah. So we had Albion, Alex's van Albion, which had a massive trailer behind it. There was stuff to go on the roof because we were carrying Graham's wonderful teepee, yurt that he'd made. He'd made for the walk this fantastic yurt. I think it must have been about 10 metres across.
Yeah.
Brand new for the walk. And we put that up on an evening if it looked like it was going to be wet, or if we particularly needed a space to be in, or on the rest days. We'd always put this massive yurt up, so we all had to learn yurt erection and taking down, which was no small task, really. It's such a big yurt.
Quite a substantial yurt. Yeah, there's enough, big enough for you all to kip in, really, wasn't it?
I mean, we ended up getting quite good at yurts.
And you had a wood burner in it as well.
There was a wood burner in it, and we had carpets for the floor. So we were carrying quite a lot of gear just to make the walk comfortable and acceptable for people who needed sort of indoors and things like that along the way. We were all very grateful of it when it was raining. We also carried a smaller yurt, which was a sweat lodge. So we took our own sweat lodge with us on the walk. And
surely you didn't set that up every night?
No, not every night. I think we probably managed it about once a week, I think.
So perhaps before your rest days, or?
No, it was
not always.
It was pretty spontaneous.
Because you need a stream, don't you? Or do you need a body of cold water?
You can do it with a tub of water and a ladle.
Okay.
To wash yourself down. Douche yourself with cold water. So no, we weren't always by streams when we had a sweat lodge. And really, it was just mooted during the day. Thinking about having a sweat lodge tonight, and Graham would gauge, the interest and
how many people were in the group at any one time. Did it change at all as you moved along?
That was one of the most fun things, and probably one of the most challenging things about the group, was that it fluctuated. The size of the group fluctuated massively along the way. We started off, I think, with sort of 20-odd people.
And it was always planned that people could join for a few days.
Oh, they'd all booked. You know, most people joined... Graham wanted people to join for at least a week, because having people coming and going for less than a week would have been sort of disruptive, I think, for the group.
Yes.
So most people joined for at least a week. Some people joined for 3 weeks. Some people joined for 2, 4, 5, 6. We had just about every variation possible. And the funny thing was that as we walked from Cornwall, the wonderful land of Cornwall, up through Devon towards Glastonbury, the group grew in size as we walked towards Glastonbury, which is a popular site, you know, with many, many fantastic places to visit and the tour.
It's funny that, because of course I've been in Glastonbury the weekend that you set off.
That's right.
The Beltane weekend, and we were doing the same thing. We were trying to carry the, unite the lands of the Albion and the land of the Condor and the land of the Eagle. Yeah. On the day of Beltane, and we were trying to carry the spirit of the Beltane flame out into society. So whilst you were down in Cornwall, and we then met in Glastonbury, didn't we?
We did.
You were on the walk, I came.
Yeah, we spoke in one of our circles around the fire. We spoke about the fact that what you were doing that weekend in Glastonbury as well, and it was a lovely resonance.
With the Sun and Serpent Mystery School,
that's right.
Of course.
Yes, that's
magic.
Right. Yeah, it was fantastic to tell the folk about that. But when we got to Glastonbury, we must have been about 35 strong, so the group grew as we...
That's quite a big group to cater for out in the field.
Yeah, yeah.
And you catered for yourselves as well, so you presumably had to develop quite a big kitchen crew to deal with 36 people.
Well, again, it was done by... Because we had these two vehicles, Albion was one of them, the other van eventually became called Awakening. So we had Awakening and Albion, the walk being called Awakening Albion.
Nice to keep things clear.
Yeah, yeah. So the white van, which was Awakening, went shopping every day. So there would be two people in Awakening, two people usually with Albion. The people in Albion went to the next campsite straight away from the last campsite to set up the camp. So sometimes that was a lot of work, depending on what needed to be done. Sometimes it was not that much
work. Hole for 36 people is quite a big hole.
It's quite a big hole to dig. And again, if it was looking wet, there was the big yurt to put up, which two people could do in a couple of hours, especially if they were with somebody like Alex, who knew what he was doing, or Graham, who knew what he was doing. We all got very good at it by the end.
I've seen the film.
There is a little speeded up film of taking down the yurt the last time. Yeah, that's really great. And the people who were driving Awakening, their job for the day was to set off from the camp, go shopping. So there was always a bit of shopping to do for the evening meal. And they also used to meet us for lunch. So whoever was on Awakening would bring lunch, which was a bit of a luxury.
It's quite demanding, isn't that, to get your support people to where you're going to be at lunchtime rather than just at the end of the day,
yeah.
Because aren't people a little bit unpredictable?
Well, no, I mean, we had our routes.
And where lunch was going to be, people made pretty bloody sure they were there.
Oh, yeah,
they didn't get lost before lunch.
You know, there was a good incentive to be there.
So people didn't get lost before lunch?
We had an agreed sort of time, rough time to meet, and a place.
Yeah.
And we didn't know what was going to be there, so sometimes the van would be parked in a field, which you'd have to find. There'd be a sort of shirt sticking up out of a hedge somewhere, but you would find them.
Hunt your lunch.
Somebody would be shouting Awakening out of a field or something. But, you know, you would find them. But, you know, sometimes people used to come in 2 hours later for lunch. So Awakening, the people who had Awakening for the day really had to be quite patient, because they would wait for people to arrive, and they would keep lunch for them.
Yeah.
They'd have hot water ready for tea, and
it's not really fair to slope off, is it?
Not really, no. And I think most people got lunch that way. And then Awakening after lunch would pack up and head on to the camp to
augment the existing crew.
To mainly set up the kitchen, which involved a couple of tables, if it was fine, and some nice big gas burners and start the veg prep and get the big pans going and get the kettle on, get the fire pit dug.
Yeah.
Get the fire going.
I know that there ended up being about sort of, there's nine of you, wasn't there, as the core group that went from the beginning to the end. But at this kind of early point when your group's still finding its feet, you know, and they've come from the normal world, so they're going to have, not necessarily going to be used to getting on with people. Some people I know find camp food a little difficult as well, because there is a tendency for omnivores to come along and be faced by just vegetarian food. And of course there's the ultimate challenge of the hole in the ground, which many people must have had difficulty with. How did it all work? You know, was life happy around the campfire at night?
I'd say, I mean, when a hole in the ground is all you've got, then you're going to use it.
Absolutely.
Personally, I don't have a problem with a hole in the ground because I've used one many times. Graham had a wonderful tool with him because, of course, sometimes people needed to use the hole in the ground during the day.
Yeah.
And he had in his bag a wonderful, he probably still has it in his bag, and I'm sure we'll be using it again, a wonderful stainless steel trowel, which was, we called it the sacred trowel, which anybody was free to borrow during the day if they were anywhere near Graham, and pop off to the woods to dig their hole and do their business.
And do as the Pope does.
And do as the Pope does. So that was quite an important tool, the trowel, actually. It got used for all sorts of things, but basically that's what we used it for.
Good idea to have a nice shiny stainless steel.
Yeah, beautiful stainless steel trowel. So that was a thing. But people, we cooked, I mean, everything we cooked was vegetarian, obviously, because it was advertised as a vegetarian walk. And it's much safer and easier and cheaper, I think, if you're going to cook for vast amounts of people.
Cleaner too, isn't it?
Cleaner.
In the field, yes.
You know. So it was all vegetarian. We weren't all vegetarian people, but most people were happy to, again, if you've done a...
There was a bit of fun with some of that, wasn't there? That was one of my favourite stories. Go on.
If you've done a long day's walking, whatever you're given at the end of the day when you're hungry and exhausted is going to taste pretty good.
Yeah. And there's some people who made a point of practice of eating roadkill.
It wasn't common, but we were given along the way. I mean, we met the most extraordinary generosity along the way. This was partly to do with the fact that Graham and Lynn had visited most of the campsites that we stayed at, and the farmers who owned the fields or whatever.
I know Graham said, though, that he was amazed by people's generosity, and how places where he didn't know where they'd be a campsite, there turned out to be one. And
absolutely.
It was like a kind of Arthurian legend, the tale of his discovering these places.
Yeah, and I mean, they had found the most fantastic places for us to stay, and because of their initial approach to these people, they were welcoming when we got there. They were expecting us, and we were given a fantastic, we were constantly stunned by the generosity we met. We were given buckets of milk from the farm, logs for the fire, wine sometimes, food. If we were camping in somebody's garden, they fed us all, every single one of us, and gave us food to travel with us the next day.
Those must have been fantastic meetings with people along the way, wasn't it? Where everybody just sort of, you know, the ultimate networking experience.
Absolutely.
Where you've only got one night only, folks.
Absolutely.
One night only.
You know,
because that's the other thing, I guess. You're on a schedule. You've got 550 miles to cover and you've got 50 days.
Well, that's the...
How much pressure did that put you under?
Well, I think people... The people who, you know, in whose fields we stayed and stuff like that, they knew and they could sense that we were on some kind of mission. I mean, it was a pilgrimage, and the campsites had been fixed for those particular nights. We only had 50 days, or I say only, we had 50 days to do the walk. If we were going to see the Beltane sunrise from Cornwall and see the solstice sunrise in Norfolk, we had to get there for the solstice sunrise. So we couldn't dally. You know, there was one time I remember on the edge of Dartmoor, I was doing the crewing that day, so I'd been setting up the camp and trying to garner some soaking wet logs from the surrounding landscape to light a very sad fire, which I did finally manage to get going. But the walkers came in. They'd been in the mist and the rain and the
it's a confusing place, Dartmoor.
Dartmoor all day. They arrived. They were exhausted. We had food and everything. And there was a meeting that night, I remember, in the yurt, which had been put up because it was a very wet day. And there was a meeting that night, and we discussed whether to stay there an extra night so that people
were knackered, were they? Yeah. It was a long day, wasn't it? And it had been damp, and people had got lost. And the thing is, you can add 4, 5, 6, 10 miles on Dartmoor.
Yeah, some people had got lost, strayed off the route. Yeah. Apparently, I mean, I wasn't up there, but apparently you couldn't see more than a few metres.
You were crewing that day,
I was crewing down in the camp, you see.
Mm. Oh, yes, sorry, but you said, yeah.
Sometimes people couldn't see more than a few metres. You just turn and you could have lost them.
No use of map.
Maps weren't much use because you couldn't see any of your reference points.
No.
Nobody had a GPS on the whole walk, it occurred to me the other day. None of us had one of those fancy objects.
I'm not sure Graham would have been too keen, would he?
No, I don't know. I mean, it just didn't occur to us, maybe, you know. So we had a discussion that night anyway about whether to stay there one extra night, which we realised during the course of this discussion would have thrown everything out of kilter.
Yeah.
So we had to accept, basically, as a group, even though there was a couple of people who wanted to hang out there for another day, and they were given the choice to do that, and then to catch us up. But the group decided, as a group, that we had to move on. We had no choice. Really, we had no choice if we were going to stick to our mission.
Yes.
So it was an interesting evening in that way, and there wasn't really any bad feeling about it, but it was just a discussion about whether it was possible to change our schedule, and we realised it wasn't.
That happened pretty early, I would imagine.
It was Dartmoor, so it was Devon, is it?
5 or 6 days.
Cornwall, is it Dartmoor?
Dartmoor's on the, it's the border, sort of Cornish side of the border, isn't it, I think.
So it was early in the walk.
Could be wrong,
we had, and that was really the only discussion we had along the way about whether to go on.
That thing was resolved.
Yeah, it'd been resolved. So we were on a mission, and really, I mean, whether it was pouring down with rain, or whether your feet were hurting, your back was hurting, or whatever was going on for you, we knew we had to carry on with the walk.
Did you, on your days off, did you have little healing sessions, or did you have means of helping each other? Was there any of that going on, or were people determined to nurse their own wounds?
No, there was a lot of, within the community of the walk, there was a lot of support for each other. I mean, we did have hot, steamy nights in the yurt where everybody massaged each other's feet and ate comfort food, like, what was it we had? That rice pudding, was it? Or something with bananas, anyway. It was kind of all creamy with bananas in, you know. And of course, we had Graham's sweat lodge with us. His fantastic little yurt that had been specially built for being a sweat lodge.
I was going to ask how you did the sweat lodges with...
Yeah, well, the stove for the sweat lodge, Graham had the special rocks that you have to use. I forget what they're called now, but they can get very, very hot without spitting and stuff.
Yeah.
So they were heated up in the fire, brought in, put into the centre of this quite small yurt. Must have been about 3 metres across.
How many people did you get in it?
Sometimes over 20.
Right.
Sometimes probably, I don't think I'm lying, and sometimes about 25 people was probably the most we got into there.
It's not too small a yurt then.
Well, you had to get pretty...
Really cramped in.
Close.
I've been in the sweat lodge. It wasn't that crowded though, was it?
No, it wasn't like that. It was comfortable.
Yeah.
I mean, sometimes, of course, there were fewer people, but I think that was about our maximum, which was pushing it, you know, for the room.
How many times did you go in and out?
You had to really, because there was only one entrance to the yurt, you had to sit.
Go in order.
Well, no, you had to, if you knew you were going to want to leave a bit early or go out, there wasn't a lot of going in and out, to be honest.
So you just went and stayed in, and when you'd finished, you came out. Okay.
With that particular...
Because sometimes people do go in and out and in and out, don't they?
If you knew that you needed to go in and out, then you had to sit right close to the entrance.
Yeah.
But basically, we stayed in once we were in there for the duration. And if you wanted to leave, then you had to just let people know that you were going to leave and skirt very carefully around this very, very hot stove that was in the thing in the centre of the yurt to get out.
Not treading on the toes of 20 other people.
Well, you have to be very careful, again, because there had been incidents, not on our walk, but previously, where people had got, you know...
And did the Sweat Lodge experience help the walk, do you think?
Of course. Oh, absolutely. I mean, it was like going into a hot womb, really, you know, or a hot room. And it was absolutely fantastic, because when we were in there, there are people, we mentioned some of the wonderful things we'd seen along the way, or the funny things we'd seen along the way. So there was a lot of warmth and laughter in there. We sang songs in there quite often. There were a lot of traditional songs and songs about earth, water, fire, spirit.
Yeah.
And most people knew some of the songs. Some people knew all of the songs. So there was some really rousing singing coming out of this little yurt. And if you weren't in there, if you were if you were fire keeper for the night, for the evening, while people were in the yurt, because somebody was out there keeping the fire going for when we came out of the yurt, then you would hear this fantastic sound coming out of this tiny yurt with all these people in there sweating away, you know.
You did a lot of singing, didn't you?
We did a lot of singing along the way. We had some people with us who were particularly keen on the singing. There's a lady called Carolyn Cumberti who is a singer and sang many, many times along the way, but a lot of us were just singing as we went. You know, you found if you had a particularly rainy day, you'd end up singing anything you could think of just to keep you going, you know. So you'd just be singing absolutely anything you could think of. There was quite a bit of dancing. I mean, if we were in a group along the way and we'd come across a standing stone or a stone circle, which we often did, especially down in Cornwall and Devon, there were many, many stone circles.
Because that's the point of the lines, isn't it? The energy lines. And lots of churches dedicated to St Michael and St Mary, which presumably would have been ancient sites before the churches turned up.
That's right. I mean, we did visit a lot of churches on the walk. Again, you know, many of them were dedicated, like you say, to St Mary or St Michael. Most of those would have been built on ancient sites that had been there a long time before the churches. And they were energy centres. Sometimes they were on the Michael line, sometimes they were on the Mary line. And because the Michael and Mary lines weave in a serpentine fashion along this straight alignment, they were crossing points of the two lines,
right,
which Hamish calls nodes. So a lot of these sites, churches, stone circles, Glastonbury, the lines do an amazing dance in Glastonbury, and again at Avebury.
Hamish said that he got to the point where he could detect those places blindfold from inside a locked van.
Yeah, well,
yes.
None of us were as good at it as Hamish, but many of us sensed the energy of these lines, especially where there were crossing points where both lines met.
Yes, and that's what caused Hamish's original confusion, wasn't it?
That's right.
He thought that was just a Michael line.
That's right.
And then eventually he realised that, of course, there was going to be a masculine and a feminine.
That's right. If they got himself and Paul Broadhurst, they got all the way to Avebury, having dowsed the line all the way from Cornwall to Avebury, before realising that there was a Mary line as well as a Michael line. You could call these lines anything you want to, really.
Yes, yin and yang, or, yes,
female, masculine, receptive, creative, whatever.
Yeah.
But they were calling them the Michael-Mary lines, and there were a lot of churches.
And didn't they tend to go into the ground where they met and then come out of it again or something, where they crossed?
There was, yes, apparently that happened. According to Hamish, that's what happened. And at some of the sites, like I say, especially Glastonbury and Avebury, they do the most amazing dance. And I'm pretty sure, I'm right in saying that Hamish was well, he's definitely one of the first people, if not the first person, to realise that this was going on Glastonbury Tor and at Avebury. They are mating, basically, the two lines.
All the time.
No, they do a very special mating dance on Glastonbury Tor.
Right.
And Avebury.
Yeah.
At the Henge and all around the Avebury complex,
yes.
They do a very complex mating game. So that was an experience, just to kind of becoming aware of that was going on,
yes.
At the same time.
Yeah.
So we weren't just following these lines, we were dancing
with
them.
Didn't you go to some interesting places? Didn't you go to a place in Marlborough?
Yeah, we did. We visited an amazing mound in Marlborough. Is it called? I can't recall, the Marlborough Mound or something like that, which is, you pretty much can't see it today. It's hidden away behind Marlborough College.
Okay, and is it in the college grounds?
I think it is, yeah. Yeah, we were allowed in to visit this fantastic mound, and we straggled in throughout the day, and we talked to the, they weren't exactly security guards.
Keepers
of the gate,
yeah.
You know, to this college. They all let us in, which was fantastic. They also let us into this amazing grotto that was built into the base of the hill, which was lined with seashells. Some Victorian lady had been inspired to build this place.
I know there was an article about it in 14
That's
Times.
That's right, there was. And that was fantastic to see,
yeah.
That. They let us in to see,
yeah.
That.
And you went to see the Mason's Cave, the so-called, or the nominal Mason's
Royston.
Cave in Royston!
That's right.
Yeah.
That was amazing, because everybody else, many of the other people on the walk, knew already a lot about this cave underneath the town of Royston.
Caves and tunnels abounding, apparently, in that part of the world, again, we're told.
Yeah, I'd heard about it, but I couldn't understand, really, why people were getting so excited about it, because I thought, yeah, OK, we're going to visit a cave today, you know, and I said, oh, Royston today, you know, going to visit this amazing cave. But when we got there, I realised what an incredible thing it is, this cave underneath Royston, right underneath the centre of the town.
Yeah.
This really deep cave, which was unlocked specially for us by this elderly chap who'd been doing it for years, who led us down this damp path down into the ground to this incredible place.
And of course it's said that it's possibly a lot older than the Masons, that it might be a Platonic or a Neoplatonic place, because it's got a kind of hole in the roof, hasn't it?
It's quite difficult to tell, because every single inch of the walls inside this cave has been carved with some incredible complex carvings, well worth looking into to see some pictures of. But there'd been a lot of erasing of older carvings and new carvings carved in on top.
And of course they can't be aged anyway, really.
It's
very difficult for us to age stone.
So who knows what was there originally?
Yeah,
it's quite difficult to tell, or,
yes.
You know, what it meant indeed.
Again, I have seen pictures of the things on the wall in there, and there is a completely bewildering array,
yeah.
Of signs and sigils.
Yeah. Just by looking at them, you can get different interpretations.
Yeah. What was your favourite place, do you think, about Alf? Because, you know, you obviously stopped in all those different places, the 100 names of Albion.
It's really difficult to say. That's very difficult to say. I think that's really very, very difficult to
name. I know
you
spent some time going through some favourite places of mine. I mean, you went past Wayland Smithy, didn't you, on the Ridgeway in Oxford?
We did.
As you said, Avebury, Glastonbury, those two little hills.
We visited
strange little hills outside Abingdon, what they called the Whitnam Clumps.
Oh, Whitnam Clumps. We camped up there, that's right. There was a fantastic view of Didcot Power Station.
Yeah.
And the sunset over Didcot was fantastic.
Going into the still beautiful countryside, but getting a bit more industrial.
I'll tell you, we visited so many churches, so many ancient sites, so many stone circles, hill forts, Uffington White Horse, Dragon Hill, Avebury, you know, so many amazing places. But one of the most extraordinary places we visited was outside a housing estate in, the name of the town escapes me at the moment, but it was outside a town, on the edges of this housing estate, there was a clump of trees in the centre of this piece of scrubby land, and we headed for it, And sure enough, this bunch of trees was enclosing one of the crossing points of the Michael and Mary lines. And we went in there, and there was plastic bottles. It was quite wet, and it was muddy, and there's quite a lot of rubbish around and stuff. And we thought, okay, and we did this at many of the places we visited. We cleared up. We took the rubbish away with us when we could, if it was, you know, practically possible to do that. So we sort of tidied up a bit and sort of thought, well, what are we going to do now? And we just spontaneously said, right, you know. So we made a spontaneous piece of kind of radial art, you could call it, in the centre of this bog.
A bit like a medicine wheel.
Yeah, in the centre of this bog. And I think we sang a song together, and we all held hands or sort of hugged each other there. And in a way, because it was such a forgotten place and a muddy, dirty...
But it was still there in the middle of this housing estate. It hadn't been built on.
Absolutely, still there. We all really enjoyed the visit there. We took away as much of the rubbish as we could and left it, hopefully, in a slightly better state.
The better for your parcel.
Hopefully. Yeah. And we did that because a lot of the places along the Mary Line, we found that the Mary Line, tended to be going along waterways and visited a lot of wells.
I was going to ask you about that.
Whereas the Michael Line visited a lot of tumps with churches on top.
Traggy
and
tours.
Higher places, okay. Which is not surprising, really, when you think about
and
it.
And were the wells still drawing water, these ancient sacred wells?
Yeah,
because they would have been there before the churches, almost for sure.
A lot of them were still used, but again, quite often we'd find them a bit neglected. So again, we'd do our best to, we'd light a candle, leave a candle there, put some flowers in, found a few, you know, little flowers along the way, maybe stick those in the well somewhere. And again, we'd take away any rubbish we found, try to leave the place with a little bit of a blessing along the way, so...
And the walk had a kind of shape to it, didn't it? And that you started off quite large and it sort of lensed its way down to the core group before starting to expand again.
Well, it was funny, really, because we were quite large around Glastonbury and massive at Avebury. I think there must have been about 50 people at Avebury.
Big supper.
Big supper, yeah. That was a fantastic experience. And then after Avebury, we dwindled down to a tiny group of 11. Which was the campsite outside Luton, which obviously hadn't been a very popular, perhaps, venue for people to book for one reason or another. But in a way, it was one of the most fantastic nights we had, because I was on the crew that day, driving the van, and the field that we'd arranged to camp in wasn't available, because there were too many horses in there, and for various reasons. So I thought, what are we going to do then? So I spoke to one of the local people, and they said... Well, that's common land over there, in between these houses. There was a patch of common land.
Again, in between houses.
Yeah, pretty much built around. Yeah. But they said, that's common land. Yeah. We don't mind if you camp there for the night. I said, are you sure? I mean, there's going to be, you know, two vans and this many tents and so many people and stuff. So they said, no, that'd be lovely. We'd like to have you there. So I contacted Graham on the old mobile and checked it out with him. And he said, yeah, okay, that sounds like a really good idea, so do that. So we had a camp in this long grass on this patch of common land, and the locals visited us. They even invited us in for showers in their houses, which was really fantastic. The children came out to spend time with us round the fire, and there was a moment that night.
Isn't that lovely, eh?
It was fantastic. There was a moment that night, we were just sitting around the fire on this patch of common land. We could hear and see Luton flight path. There was planes practically flying overhead, coming in and out of Luton Airport.
You've got motorways there as well.
Which was quite noisy. The roads were a bit... We weren't actually close to a motorway that night, but there were roads nearby.
Did the planes go all night? Or did they switch them off?
I think they did stop for a while, but then they started pretty early again in the morning. But we had these planes in and out of Luton flying overhead. We were all sitting around a campfire on a patch of common land drinking tea. And we could also hear fantastic audio landscape. We could also... There was a church just across the field. And that was a Sunday evening. So the church... We could hear this fantastic singing coming out of this church. And that was all going on this little patch of common land outside Luton.
Yeah.
And we were all struck, I think, by, you know, how fantastic it was, really, to be able to do that in the merry land of England in these days, you know, to, and to be welcomed by the locals.
Yeah.
I mean...
See, again, it makes me feel that you're pulling aside a veil. I think again and again, we heard from Litmus last week, that people are so decent.
Yeah.
You know, they want to help, they want to give you stuff, and they want to get on. People want to get on.
Yeah. As soon as people along the way, they'd ask us, you know, said, oh, where are you walking to? You know, you walk into so-and-so, like the next place,
yes,
you know.
Yes, yes.
And we'd say, well, no, actually. Sometimes you wouldn't tell them about the walk, but most times you would say, no, we're actually walking to Norfolk. You're not, you know. And then they'd realise, they would get chatting and stuff. And there was one lovely occasion, I remember, when we were walking past a bus stop, and... Mel Long, lovely young lady who did the whole walk with us, she met this lady and got chatting to her, and it turned out it was this lady's birthday that day.
Right.
So there was a little group of us that arrived while Mel was talking to this lady at the bus stop, and Mel said, it's, can't remember her name, you know, it's Doris's birthday today. So we all stood around and sang happy birthday to her, and she was nearly in tears.
I bet she was really moved.
There were tens, hundreds of little occasions like that along the way where...
You're sort of weaving a spell as you cross the country.
Spontaneous acts of madness and kindness along the way, you know.
Yeah.
People were very generous, and there were... something I remembered I was doing... I was quite keen on making things out of bits of hedgerow and stuff on the way and leaving them about, like weaving circles out of ivy and stuff, and just hanging them up and just leaving them there. And a lot of other people did. And one of the things we did that was fantastic was along the way we learnt that it really helped if we made arrows on the track to show if there was a change of direction.
Okay, so people could follow, they didn't have to stay together as a group, they could follow in their own time.
Oh, and we did. I mean, we strung out, there was quite often a couple of hours between the...
Did you have somebody in front and behind to sweep?
Not really, no. I mean, there were a group of, quite often it was Graham and Steve and Alex at the front.
Yeah.
They were our pioneers, our leaders, and quite often it was Graham who had the map, who knew a bit about the route. So it was quite often that he was our leader, so to speak. And so they were at the front, and quite often people would be 2 hours later following. So we developed this method of making
since
these
lunchtime.
Well, at any point during the day, really, you'd end up with a 2 hour gap between the front and the back of the group.
Yeah.
But there was nobody really at the back who knew where they were going any more than anybody else did, really. So that people did get lost along the way, but these arrows really helped. And some of them were totally charming. We'd make them from whatever we found along the way.
Yeah.
So if there was a change in route or a path was going off the track into another field or something like that, we'd build an arrow out of grass and bits of wood and, you know, a plastic fairy or whatever you found along the way.
You used some chalk, didn't you, at some stage?
Oh, that was great. We had, we were running out of chalk because we walked, a lot of the walk was on the Ridgeway, which was fantastic because it's like made out of chalk. So there was loads of chalk. We gathered all these bits of chalk and took them with us. By the time we got to East Anglia, we were actually running out of chalk. And I saw these line painters one day. The men had a lorry and they were line painting, but before they paint the lines, they mark it all in chalk on the road. And I saw these fantastic big pieces of chalk they had. You know, they were about six inches long and about an inch across.
Just what we need.
Yeah, and I went up to these guys and I told them a little bit about what we were doing, and I said, and I really fancy your bits of chalk, you know, any chance you might. And they gave us several of these really nice big chunks of chalk, which we used for days and, well, probably for the rest of the walk, actually. Yeah. They kept us going for the rest of the walk. And again, there were so many spontaneous acts of kindness along the way. Yeah. But what I was going to say was, I didn't know what they were at the time, but I was finding these hoops, these metal hoops along the way, quite often by roads. And I would pick them up because they were quite nice.
Things to weave things in.
Metal circle. Yeah. So I would weave a bit of ivy round and stick, you know, little flowers or whatever
feathers
I found,
and
feathers and bits and pieces and stuff. And they ended up looking quite pretty. And if I met somebody on the walk and they'd say, oh, that's nice, or what are you doing there, or something, I'd say, well, I've just made it, would you like it? Or or sometimes I would just leave it hanging on a branch at the campsite we'd been at, or something like that, so there was something there. And it was only later I realised that they were the part of old tyres from vehicles.
Oh, they have a metal ring in them.
There's a metal ring in them
and
somewhere.
And the rubber had all gone.
And that's all that was left.
And,
yeah, I think that's what they are anyway, because I always found them by roads.
Yeah.
And I was thinking what a nice thing that was to do with a bit of an old tyre, was to turn it into a little miniature kind of work of art made out of natural materials.
And hand it on.
And leave it with the people along the way.
Well, there you go, folks. You're listening to Dr. Rock's radio show on tnsradio.com. And Synchro Sister and Nick M discussing the Awakening Albion Walk, which was a walk that happened over between Beltane and the summer solstice in 2008. And there's a bit more of that to go, but I thought I'd just come in for a minute and let you know what it was you were listening to and who you were listening to. For those of you that are waiting for more news on White Rabbit's idea of a permanent court of record, I shall return to that in a bit. But I thought for the moment I didn't really want to seriously interrupt the kind of atmosphere that Synchro's managing to set up. You can hear the enthusiasm for the walk in her voice. It's really nice to know that this very night, as we're listening to this, she's out there starting a new walk. In the meantime, here's a little bit more of it for you.
So, there we go, back again. Just a little bit of a pause there.
Where were we?
So, we were in Luton, but I think we just have a little bit of a chat in between times there. Mm. I think you wanted to return to the subject of the roadkill. I remember it being quite an interesting sort of subject amongst the group, if nothing else, because... Well, there must have been times when there was challenge, and I remember that being one where...
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, some of the people on the walk were pretty strict vegetarians, and because the walk had been advertised as a vegetarian walk, they thought it should be totally kind of vegetarian walk. But there were occasions when we were given fish, and everybody agreed that as long as it was cooked... in Alex's van on another frying pan that would be okay, yes. Sort of thing. But there was one occasion which was quite funny really, and it did cause a bit of a stir, where there was a rabbit. Alex was always looking out for creatures along the way that might be useful or eaten or have a tail taken from them or a wing or something. But this rabbit was found one day, and it was strung up onto a stick and carried along with us. What we must have looked like sometimes. I mean, Jerry, our wonderful Australian grandfather, who was over 70 at the beginning of the walk, called us the raggle-taggle gypsies, because we must have looked like a motley crew. And then to be carrying a rabbit on a stick with us as well, back to our camp to eat.
Just like olden times!
And there was a discussion about it, I remember, and some people weren't particularly in favour of it. But again, Alex was open about the fact that he was quite keen to eat meat, and there were probably some bacon sandwiches eaten along the way in Alex's van. Well, there definitely was. And this rabbit was cooked, and anybody who wanted some was invited to join in and have some. So it wasn't a totally vegetarian walk, and it didn't
cause too much grief.
Well, you know, there was some disagreement about
there must have been some. Was it really quite a peaceful... Did it manage to roll along quite nicely, or was it? Did it sometimes get a little bit East Enders-y?
Well, no, I think because we were on this mission, we were quite busy. And tired at the end of the day. You know, there was all that to do that we talked about earlier with the moving of the camp and the setting up of the next camp and everything. That there were individual difficulties, you know, there were physical problems that people had to deal with, blistered feet and all that kind of thing, or a strained ankle or whatever. But we were pretty free of kind of physical ailments caused by the walk, but some people brought sort of physical ailments with them, which had to be dealt with. And there was little stresses about things like not being able to charge mobile phones, and because we didn't have a means of charging a mobile phone with us, so people wanted to keep in touch with the outside world and stuff like that. So the individual stresses, though, I think, became subsumed by the energy of the walk and the mission overtook...
Its momentum
overtook those individual difficulties, really.
I think that's worth pausing over, isn't it, really? Mm. Because that's not what we would necessarily expect from the kind of messages we're given, are we? We're led to believe that it's difficult for people to cooperate and that it's difficult to pull stuff off and that they don't get on and that human nature does all sorts of things that gets under our feet. And yet we're saying this is an immensely... You've outlined how complicated it is. It's sort of a complicated thing to be pulled off and people got together and did it.
Mm. Yeah. There was something about the momentum of the walk that everybody involved felt, and I think it was really good that we had this core of like 9 people who did the whole thing from the beginning to the end, because the perspective we managed to garner along the way and gather, if you like, was also a part of that momentum that kept the whole ball rolling. We didn't realise, I don't think, until the end of the walk how important that had been to keep the walk, to keep the ball rolling along the way, because a lot of other people joined the walk for a very short period of time, although they had quite fantastic experiences themselves for the week or two they were with us. They didn't have that perspective of the whole thing.
And the sections of the walk were very different, weren't they? Cornwall and Devon and then Avebury and Glastonbury and then Luton and and then into Norfolk, where you were on the walk. We'd see really different things.
That's right. I mean, the changes we saw, because we set off in the beginning of May and ended up in by the sea in June 21st. The changes we saw along the way in the flora, the animals we saw along the way, the landscape and how it changed along the way was phenomenal. I mean, I had no idea before I set off what we were going to experience really along the way in terms of how wonderful the merry land of England really is.
Of course, those of us who weren't on the walk did get a chance to see the whole thing on Sarah Camera's marvellous production.
Yeah, there's a DVD made of the photographs that Sarah took along the way. What she did was she had this fantastic camera with her, and she took thousands and thousands of stills of shots along the way, all the way from Cornwall to Norfolk, and edited those shots down into a film, like a filmic sequence of stills, which took about 39 minutes to show, I think. And had some amazing cello music set to it.
That's right, and that was the 39 minutes is the difference between the sunrise time at Cornwall and the sunrise time at Hopton.
There were a lot of synchronicities about the length of this DVD.
Is that film generally available, or is she still holding on to it? Is it possible to buy copies of it?
I don't think it's for sale. Sarah would probably provide anybody who wanted to.
This is certainly a pretty amazing experience.
Yeah, I mean, she might have copies that she could sell.
I remember especially the bits where you're going down an ancient track and she's using particularly a series of photographs that are particularly close to each other, so you get the feeling of really rapid movement. Because she does that, effectively, she does the whole 540 miles in 39 minutes.
Yeah.
And you really do feel like you need to sit down and have a cup of tea and a rich tea biscuit by the time you've finished that.
Well, Sarah's project, we called her Sarah Camera because she was using this camera every day, all day. But when she couldn't be on, when she needed to crew, or I think she was called away to London at one point, when she couldn't be using the camera, she would leave the camera with some trusted members of the group and they would do the filming for that day. So in a way we all got involved in this project of Sarah's, and even to the point of people saying, well, it's okay, Sarah, I'll crew today so that you can do the filming. You know, so there was a lot of cooperation amongst the members of the group.
People taking each other's needs on board and accommodating them.
You had to, really, because the thing wouldn't have rolled along unless we'd all done that.
So it did, it rolled all the way past Luton, and presumably as it started getting close to its end, you started attracting more people again, did you?
We did, yes.
Because you're in Graham's home, the group's home turf then, really, aren't you?
For a lot of the people involved in the walk, they were walking home. As far as I was concerned, I was walking to a foreign land. I'd been once, I think, to East Anglia before in my life, and having walked from Cornwall and Devon with their amazing hills all along the downs and everything, and then to end up in this, what I would call flatland, East Anglia, Norfolk and Suffolk. It was fantastic, but for a lot of people they were walking home, so they had this tremendous feeling of homecoming. It was quite interesting, actually. Towards the end of the walk, there were a lot of mixed feelings amongst the group, because we knew that this amazing experience was coming to an end, and many of us didn't want to focus on the fact that it was coming to an end. So we kind of sometimes didn't want to talk about the end, but we were aware that that was happening, because you couldn't not be aware of the fact that you'd been walking for 5 weeks and there were only two left.
Yeah.
And then you'd been walking for 6 weeks and there was only one left. And we finally arrived in a place called Summer Leighton, near the sea, but a few miles away from the sea, from the place called Hopton-on-Sea, I think, which is the final place we visited. We camped in this, it was an estate, I think it was like a stately home in their kind of garden. Again, there was a church there. We must have visited hundreds of churches along the way. And interestingly enough, the churches were the places where we all met in the village. You'd say, well, we're heading for such and such village, see you in the churchyard. Mm. Because it was an easy place to find.
Where the water was, you said, as well.
And it was always a bit of a sanctuary for us, because there was always a tap.
Yeah.
The first thing I would do when I arrived at the church was not necessarily to go in and sing, which was the first thing some other people did, but was to walk all the way around the church to find the tap so that we could all fill up our water bottles. And most churches had taps, which I hadn't actually realised was the case until we'd done this walk.
Tell us about the church with the shiny knob in it.
Oh, the old font.
Yeah.
Oh, that was down in Lostwithiel, wasn't it? Down in Cornwall, down that part of the country. Yeah, there's this very, very old font, which I think was actually at a crossing point of the lines. Yeah, there's this, just this incredible sort of bulbous gargoyle on and with a spiral on this bump, a very fondleable bump, shall we say. And it was shiny with all the hands that had fondled it over the years. Absolutely shiny.
Yeah.
Fantastic. Yeah.
Show you my knob.
That's right, yeah, it had been well fondled over the years.
So you did get to the end.
We did finally get to the end, and I must admit there was a lot of sadness when we arrived at Summer Leighton. We'd walked along drained land that day, and some of it is even below sea level in that part of the world. I think it's the first time I'd ever walked on land that was actually below sea level.
Yeah.
I couldn't believe it, looking at the map and seeing the contours going below naught, you know, down to minus one, minus
two. I've never even seen it on a map.
Yeah, it's there, the contours are there. But we arrived at this house, and there was a river in between us and where we wanted to go. And Graham had managed to talk this this guy, John, I think he was called, who had a tiny little boat. Graham had managed to talk him into ferrying us all across the river to get to the other side so that we could go to get to Summer Leighton and our final camp.
Excellent. And it was, how many could you get in the ferry?
Well, it wasn't a ferry, it was a tiny little boat. And he actually had us in his garden before we tried to cross this river in his tiny little motorboat, and told us loads of horror stories about the strong currents there and how people had been swept away and everything. And
don't pay the ferryman.
He provided us all with tea. He pulled out a bottle of brandy. He was well prepared for us and hosted us and entertained us with all these stories for good couple of hours we must have been there. And then we approached this tiny little boat, motorboat, and I think it was himself and four of us, I think, could go over.
Yeah.
And it was borderline whether it was three or four, on depending on the size of the people, basically. It was a tiny little thing.
Yeah.
And he ferried us all across, with to much hilarity, I must admit.
It's right at the end of the walk.
Right on the last day of the walk, we were all ferried across.
Don't you think that's really great? Nice symbolic, metaphorical thing, the crossing of the river at the end of the...
Well, he used to be the ferryman. He used to do the ferry for that patch of river, and he hadn't done it for years, and John managed to...
Yeah.
Graham managed to persuade him to resurrect this... this little boat and kind of take us across. It was a great experience. We laughed and we cried.
Very charismatic man, isn't he?
Absolutely, absolutely. An inspiration in himself, really.
Yeah.
So the last day, we arrived at this place, Summerleighton, and set up the camp. And like I say, it was very moving. And we were, everybody was well aware that it was the last night of the camp. And we gathered loads of people. There must have been... There was loads of visitors, people who knew Graham, had heard about the walk, had been part of the organising of the walk, had joined us for the last kind of week or two of the walk, so we'd been gathering people along the way. And there was a mixed mood of celebration and sadness, and it was a wonderful mixture.
Yes.
The two together.
There's some fantastically atmospheric photos in the book of that, those...
Yeah.
Last meetings on the beach.
Well, what we did from Summerleighton, you see, was we were there for the evening, and I think we had our evening meal, and people were washing and getting ready for walking at night all the way. We walked late that night, must have been about 10, 11 o'clock or something like that. We walked in semi-darkness to Hopton, which was a few miles. And then we walked from the old ruined church at Hopton. We met there at the old ruined church, and I think we sang some songs and did what we did. And we walked from there. We must have been about 50 strong by that time. And then we walked from Hopton, the church at Hopton. We walked in silence all the way down to the sea and got onto the beach where we were going to spend the night waiting for the solstice sunrise. Some people pretty gleeful. We haven't seen the sea since Cornwall. Penzance, I think, was the last time we'd seen the sea.
Yeah.
So some people ripped all their clothes off and just went straight in to this freezing...
It's the other sea as well, isn't it?
It's the other sea. Which sea is it? It's the North Sea.
Yeah.
Dived in. And then we spent... Alex, who was not called Wildfire Man for nothing, he made fire with the sticks... The drill method.
He's really swift at, isn't he?
Really swift at. He had some really dry tinder that he'd been collecting specially for the purpose. Built this little fire. A few whips of the bow drill. Instant fire.
And he made fireworks as well, didn't he?
Oh, well, that wasn't actually Alex.
Wasn't it?
No, that wasn't Alex. That was Nate from America.
Oh, I remember. For somebody who visited for a while on the
wall. Yeah, he knew how to make these amazing fireworks. Perhaps there's some fantastic photographs in the book of these fireworks. They were some of the most spectacular fireworks I've ever seen.
They're made out of chicken wire
not chicken wire. They were made out of quite thick fencing-type wire and wire wool.
Okay.
And I think we used a chain.
Yeah.
And what a ball of this quite thick fencing wire, a cage made out of quite thick fencing wire, stuffed with this wire wool on a chain.
Yeah.
The wire wool was, perhaps we shouldn't be going into this in too much detail.
Don't try this at home, folks.
the wire wool was lit.
Make sure you're doing the biggest room you've got.
You had to actually do it in a separate field.
Yeah, so...
You had to be
The observers were at least one hedge away from fire.
You had to be a good distance away from the firework
because it
sprayed molten red-hot metal everywhere, so it has to be done very, very carefully.
Possibly not as environmentally friendly as some of the things you
had to. It was an incredible experience to see it and be a part of it, for sure.
But anyway, here you were on the beach, setting fire to doing the bow drill fire, the wildfire.
Yeah, and we had a fantastic fire. Some people had brought their sleeping bags and their blankets and stuff, and we huddled around this fire all night. There was the bit of Stone's ginger wine, I think I had that night. There was hot chocolate made on the fire. We'd brought all sorts of things with us to entertain us through the night. There was music again, probably. There was people snoring around the fire. And eventually the sun rose, which was a fantastic moment. I mean, we were so lucky, I think, to see the Beltane sunrise and the solstice sunrise at the end of the walk.
Many is the year I've spent trying to see solstice sunrises, and they're pretty rare.
It could have been so other. But we did see the sunrise. It was touch and go, I must admit, yeah, because there were some clouds on the horizon. We weren't quite sure whether we were going to see it or not.
Lovely, it's the way Sarah's film ends.
But then it did.
With the waves lapping.
That's right, the sun rose. And it was a very moving moment. And then there was a bit of, there was loads of hugging. The 9 people who'd done the whole walk were gathered together into a little huddle, and we had, there were many, there were tears.
Classic group of 9, 9 lords of the underworld, 9 ring wraiths, brilliant. The 9 permanent walkers of Albion.
9 rings to bind them all, or whatever, 1 ring to bind them all. The 9 huddled together and had a bit of a moving hug, and then we opened up and all of the 50 people, or more by that time, were there. Some people came to join us for the last night on the beach. So I think by the time we left, we straggled away from the seaside, a very moved and I think a very different group to the group that had originally met in Cornwall. We'd all been changed by the experience.
Yeah.
In ways that we didn't even probably begin to imagine until we'd spent some time after the walk assimilating the experience.
Now, now 2 or 3 years down the line, you're very shortly going to embark on a 2-week walk.
Yeah.
With some of the same team.
Yeah. Graham. Joyce
slightly more relaxed enterprise by the sound of it.
I think so. I mean, again, it's going to be a completely different experience, but the about half of the people who are going on this walk in Norfolk and Suffolk that I'm going on soon are people who were involved in the Albion Walk.
Yeah.
So there'll be a lot of old faces to reconnect with. And,
Like the first 2 weeks in July, isn't
that's
it?
That's right, yeah, that's right. And it's going to be run in a similar sort of way. We're going to be crewing ourselves, which is a way of keeping the walk reasonably priced. It also means
that... What sort of price is it for a...
I can't remember offhand.
I remember.
But it's quite reasonable. It also means that there isn't this split between the people who are crewing the walk, providing the transport and the camp and everything. We are doing that ourselves. So that means that everybody gets a taste of digging the fire pit, digging the pit for the loo, driving the vans, setting up camp and everything. Everybody's involved in that. So there isn't that division between staff and hunter that you get so often in the real world.
I suppose some people do a bit more of it than others, inevitably.
Yeah, I mean, some people are more happy driving a large van with a trailer than others.
Yeah.
So, yeah, there's some people...
Presumably there's some people you wouldn't let touch that sort of job with a 10-foot pole.
Most people knew if they weren't up to that job, really. So they would end up perhaps driving at Awakening and being more involved in the shopping.
Yeah.
And the cooking and that side of things. Yeah. So people
great,
found their
it?
Niches,
yeah,
I think.
Yeah, you can distribute large amounts of stuff over the team.
If somebody wasn't, you know, too keen on, cutting out the fire pit, for example, then there would be somebody who would be.
Yeah, nobody's going to force them to do it.
Exactly. I mean, you know, everybody had to find what they were happy with, what they could do, and take a turn in the work.
Yeah.
One of the jobs that involved a lot of people and we got so good at by the end of the walk was packing everything up in the morning. The final packing was... so efficient.
Yeah.
It was hilarious, and we were sort of crying and laughing at the same time about that, you know,
so
that
after,
stage.
After that sunrise, you went to put everything away and went your separate ways.
Yeah.
So by lunchtime, everybody had...
Yeah, everybody'd gone.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So this thing that had taken many months of Graham's time to organise and nearly 2 months of your lives to pull off was suddenly not there anymore.
The whole thing took 7 weeks.
And have you met at all again since
the
walk?
There's been several meetings since the walk for various occasions. Yeah, there's been quite a lot of meeting, and there's been quite... that even if people haven't been communicating by email or phone or whatever like that, there were connections made on that walk that are a different kind of connection somehow.
Well, you've worked together,
you know,
hadn't you? Lots of other things.
Yeah.
You've made an intentional community.
That's right. That's right.
And lots of those people must... I mean, you and I, we've had a go at community, we've lived in communities, we've visited other communities. There must have been some people there who perhaps had never tried community.
Yeah.
Even.
I mean, I think it wouldn't be wrong to say at all that the whole experience was a completely transformational experience for everybody involved. And many people's lives, including my own, I think, have changed as a result of being involved in that whole process. I don't think our lives... You could never really just go back to the way things were before an experience like that and expect things not to have changed.
No.
Perspectives changed.
I found that just with a 12-day motorcycle trip to Czechoslovakia and back. I literally was a life-changing experience, and massively so.
I don't think
I ever really went back to work again. So 55 days on the ground.
Yeah,
you know,
an incredibly empowering experience as well, because
walking the earth.
You know, when you look at the map, I know that you were marking on the map these red blobs every campsite we stayed in.
It's really great. I've got a road map with little pink dots on it of everywhere you were. Yeah. Yes,
and
yes.
You know, when I look
all
at
the way
that,
across, all the way, yeah, all the way across England.
I find it hard to believe that we did that distance in a relatively short period of time.
So and it happened, didn't it, as well? There weren't any disasters, there wasn't anything that kind of chucked you off your sight, your aims. And
no, it really did happen.
Yeah.
And that was mainly because of Graham and Lynn's fantastic organisation in the first place of the sites and everything, but also this momentum that we gathered as we went along the way that kept the whole thing going, I think.
Some would say you were riding the energy lines and they were working with you as well. Hamish certainly believes that just by trying to douse something, you're engaging with a communicative entity.
That's right.
And if you're moving along these energy lines and you're doing it with intent and you're singing and you're dancing and you're getting on, most of all, you know, that... And also, you've got all the energy that goes into inspiring such a thing and the fact that you're actually doing it.
Yeah.
All of that. And the energy lines themselves, if Gaia is a conscious entity, which we believe her to be, they'd have been spinning your story with you, wouldn't they?
Certainly, certainly. Interestingly enough, I've just heard recently that the ruined church at Hopton, where we gathered that night before we set off for the sea, is being renovated in some way. There's a gentleman down there who is gathering some, trying to get some funds together to renovate the church.
Very good.
Which was in total ruin when we were there. I don't know whether he's intending to use it as a church again or just to restore the building, which is a really old place. So it's just interesting that that's happened since the walk. Yeah.
Well, I think that's been a very interesting talk.
Good.
We'll have to get back to you when you've done the Waveney walk.
Well, that's right.
The Waveney walk.
What I'm getting more and more interested in now is the idea of doing a very long walk. I mean, that was a very long walk. That was a kind of 500...
Miles is pretty long.
I'm beginning to hatch the idea of, in spring 2012, of walking from possibly the very north of Scotland, or possibly even one of the islands off the coast of Scotland.
Possibly off at Callanish.
Possibly Callanish or Orkney, I'm not quite sure yet. Probably Callanish, if we can get there. And then, of course, we'd have to ferry across the sea. But to walk all the way from northern Scotland down to the south of England somewhere. And I'm hatching this idea at the moment, and I just thought I'd put it out there as an idea that's being brewed, to walk as some kind of community, probably a fluctuating in size community, along...
Yeah, you wouldn't be starting off with too many people up at Callanish.
Probably not, but it would be really lovely if it was the kind of walk that people, if we could get the news out on some of the networks that we're both involved in and developing at the moment, get the news out that people could join the walk for however long they wanted to along the way. So there would be a community of walkers, probably a core group again, who would want to be doing the whole thing if they possibly could, of which I'd really like to be one, and then people could meet and join in. And I've got this idea that it would be a walk for liberty and peace.
Yeah.
That's kind of the idea I'm brewing at the moment.
Liberty, peace and delight.
Liberty, peace and fun, you know. I mean, I'm sure it would be an enormous amount of fun as well. And it could be a very effective way of approaching December 2012, which, you know,
yes, moving
could
your
be
way,
a very interesting
moving your
time.
Way towards it, treading the land, because as we were talking about earlier, Melchizedek, John Varlo Melchizedek's advice for 2012 was that it doesn't matter where you are, it's what you're doing that will count.
Yeah.
And I think we're beginning to see how that's true, isn't it? How where you put your mind changes what happens to you. So
if we can find a group of people who want to do that...
Well, we're not given advice to be walking with gnomes.
That's right. Walking the land seems to be a very good thing to do. And also, the people you meet along the way and the influence they have on you, you have on them, the generosity that something like that inspires... It would be just wonderful to set something like that up. So I'm going to talk to the people on these walks I'm going on soon to see if we can...
See who's up for it.
Yeah, and to see if we can formulate some kind of idea, inspire, you know.
Yeah, I'm sure people will be up for it. As you know, I've always had a bit of a yearning to do a pilgrimage, and wandering all the way from the top to the bottom. It would take many months, would it not?
Well, I know that Graham's walk from Glasgow to Greenham took 11 weeks over that.
They must have been moving at a fair old lick.
Yeah, I don't know. I will talk to him about it in more detail this time when I see him, because I'd like to know how they organised that.
Yeah, because I think it is important to try and get it. I always liken these sort of things to like a firework display. The firework display looks really good to people that are watching it, but to the guy that's setting it off, it's just an endless string of burning matches.
Well, that's it.
And,
it would be
interesting. You know, to go hammering across the country like you did, it's difficult to appreciate where you are.
We were doing, probably 15...
You're averaging 10 miles a day, roughly, but you had a day off each week, so that means you're averaging a little bit more, doesn't it? 12 or 13, maybe, something like that.
And quite often we walked 15 miles in the day.
Yeah.
But, you know, you wouldn't necessarily have to do that many miles a day. I don't know how long it would take. You'd probably need about 3 months for it, I think.
Mm. Yeah.
I think you'd need at least 3 months. Well, that's only 12 weeks, isn't it? So, you'd need at least.
Yeah. Be spectacular.
Be great. So anyway, I'm just putting that out there, hatching the idea at the moment.
Chance to visit loads of ancient sites.
Yeah, would be really lovely
to
catch a few of those on the way.
Get your larynx out.
Yeah, and you could attract a lot of interesting people along the way and maybe partake and create some interesting events along the way as well.
Yes, no reason why not. Do a bit of live broadcasting.
Yeah, could do a bit
of
that.
Some music.
Yeah.
Very good. All sounds great.
Yeah. We'll see what we can hatch.
Yeah, well, we'll keep in touch, eh?
Well, there you go. You're back live with Dr. Rock's radio show on tnsradio.com. And that was the Synchro Sister describing the Awakening Albion Walk, which was completed in 2008 and turned out to be the introduction to, new adventures, really. So there she is. She's away for a couple of weeks out walking again. Meeting more people, cleaning up more messy places, and Dr. Rock's been out the back kind of doing his speciality, freezing plenty of slices of beans on toast in preparation for it, so we'll probably not be starving, but what a fantastic tale, really. I mean, this idea of the people, the punters, if you like, the people who are paying the money, and if I remember rightly, it really was maybe £20 a day or something. I remember the cost being really pretty insignificant, but the fact that the customers are also the crew, you know, the customers are effectively the hosts to some degree because of the cooking and the fire making and the driving, if nothing other than the fact that, you know, everybody needed a bit of help at some point during it, especially Sarah Camera, because she was doing an amazing and particularly unique thing, which I'll describe in a minute. But people were willing, when Sarah Camera was due to crew for her, on one occasion, as I think Rayanne mentioned, she had to leave the walk through, you know, just had to happen, and people took over the camera and the downloading, and tell you now what she was doing was she was taking thousands upon thousands upon thousands of photographs, more or less on a daily basis. She photographed again and again and again the whole walk, the whole 500 odd miles. And then what she did was she put together this 39-minute movie, but it's a movie of stills. So it literally kind of flickers into life in front of you. And it's as such, it's really quite an exciting experience. It's really quite really fizzy, because things move really, really quickly. You can sometimes, they're on an ancient track for quite a while, and in that case what you get is a really consistent view. You get to see plenty of horses, but you get to see absolutely nothing for more than, say, a quarter of a second. There are no humans in it at all, with one tiny tribute exception, or it is all landscape and some creatures, which is what they were doing. They were witnessing the land. So the whole group effectively helped Sarah Camera, and that was just like a big example of how the whole group was constantly helping itself, obviously, because it's survival and it's entertainment and everything. It was doing everything for itself. They hadn't got chargers for the mobile phones, and they didn't have a GPS. They were using maps, and sometimes as the maps really don't always match what's on the ground. Sometimes they really are quite seriously out of date. And also, if you're doing something like what Sarah Cameron was doing, with your eye poking through a lens all the time, you don't always notice those beautiful floral or painted arrows that they were making to show you which way to go. So every now and then people were doing several miles over the top, but they were just moving along fantastic as a group, pulling off all of this. And I've done similar things at festivals where I used to pay good money to go to festivals and watch some corporate outfit thrashing out some rock and roll, which was always good. But it's so much more fun to actually go there as a kind of customer, because obviously you're enjoying everything that's happening, but to be on the crew at something, to be actually part of what's going on, to be, if you like, a punter as well as a host, to be both of those things. It completely changes the responsibilities and the cost benefit analysis and everything. It's really quite a remarkable transformation. So they were doing that all the time, their 50-55 days. They didn't have anybody other than themselves serving them. And they went basically past a series of ancient wells and churches, and wherever they found things slightly grubby, they tidied them up. And I think it's absolutely clear that these ancient sites were there long before the churches got there, the ancient sites, because if nothing else, all of the churches are, I believe, connected with a Christian saint, and each of those saints has a sort of saint's day, if you like, and each of the saints, I think, almost certainly were taking over kind of like the positions of minor spirits or influences or field effects that had been noticed by the ancients. So even they were perhaps a replacement for something more ancient, and it's more than just a nod, you see. I mean, I think it's John Michel, in fact, who this kind of whole exercise was dedicated to, you know, by Hamish Miller, who came up with the information. I could be wrong. I'm pretty sure it was John Michel that many churches are aligned slightly differently from each other, in that they're each aligned with the rising sun on their saint's day. So that means that there's a kind of nod there to probably ancient wisdom that's well buried. So these places that these walkers were going, and sometimes there was upwards of 50 of them, and at other times there was never fewer than 9, say, or never fewer than 11, I think, in fact. And they were visiting all these ancient sacred places, which is one of the things that's really been recommended to me by many people, not just for my own personal, you know, wealth, but for the Commonwealth and for the wheel of the ancient sites themselves. The idea that Hamish communicates with these sites, or communicated when he was here, with these sites by dowsing the energies within them, and that the sites responded by changing the information they were prepared to give him. And he did douse some of the most amazing things. I remember him dowsing a flower of life, which is a really beautiful geometric design, which involves a central circle with 6 other circles spread equidistant around it, and he wasn't aware of that design when he doused it, so he was quite surprised to come across it, I think, in a cellar somewhere. But there you go, this brilliant idea, the two of them, John Michel and Hamish Miller, and they went through these Michael and Mary places. One of the things I really liked was the tales of these these ancient springs that are there in housing estates. You know, to all intents and purposes, the common land has all disappeared. The fact that these sites are there means, my guess is that at one stage there was quite a lot of common land around it, but in some of these places these ancient spaces are still there, and they were able to go in there and tidy up a little bit, do a bit of singing, light some incense and what have you, and bring a bit of the energy back to the lines. And I think this is quite important work. I know many of us listening to this radio station realise that as well as the real and physical stuff that we need to do, there's this other vibrational world that needs to be supported and learnt from. And the way these people moved across the country, just meeting what was described as hundreds of occasions when members of the general public were met, and everybody had a really, really cracking time as a result. And, you know, there was the metaphorical equivalent of lashings of ginger beer and strawberries and cream and what have you. And anything they wanted, really, they had a really beautiful time with the people they met. And everybody, of course, is having a thoroughly unusual time of it, which is one of the things that we can really, again, really help with, is to break the kind of deadly rhythm of everyday life with genuinely human experiences. When seeing other people do unusual things certainly makes you wonder whether you might consider doing one or two unusual things yourself. So what a brilliant thing for them to be doing. Unbuilt places, tidying them up, meeting the general public, and creating an unusual and affirming experience for as many people as possible. The idea of these arrows they built, they built some really beautiful arrows with flowers and natural objects and things. So they were functional. They told the walkers where to go, but they were also works of art, information and artifacts at the same time. Beauty and functional. Beautiful and functional at the same time, something we really do seem to have lost a bit of a grip of with the design of most of the things that we're doing. They managed to sort out loads of difficulties between themselves. You know, when somebody had to decide what to do, there had to be some kind of decision on what was going to be done about the meat and the vegetarian thing, because there were some people that were evidently going to eat meat, especially if it was presented, just, you know, presented by the forces of whatever. And there were other people who really didn't want that to happen, but an accommodation was reached, which is of course the kind of administrative process that we'd all like to enter, where there's a load of questions asked, there's a load of opinions kind of exchanged, and eventually some sort of resolution is achieved with which everybody can live. And I should imagine that also was happening on a kind of fractal level, if you like. I would imagine that was happening on all sorts of levels through the group throughout all of the time that the walk was happening. And of course, when people are behaving like that, they're really in the present, because they're really paying attention to what other people are thinking and wanting, and because you have to, because like Synchro said, the momentum of the walk is carrying you all along, and something bigger than, if you like, the personal tensions sort of forms around the whole project, although the personal tensions are still there, but they're being resolved in the same way. So once again, we get to see a point where potential areas of opposition and disagreement and what would, you know, we're told, what seems, looking around us, normally leads to breakdown, can in fact, you know, lead to progress and further cohesion. This sort of third point in a polarity is the point where we can either resolve or continue a problem. And they seem to have done persistently well in not continuing the problem and resolving anything that set itself up as they moved along. I love the story of the shiny knob. They had a sort of demon knob on a font, which is really great. It was a really sort of devilish looking thing as far as I remember. And there's a local church near where we live. When we first moved here, there was a carved stone there, which was a Shina Nagig, which is an ancient fertility symbol involving quite a large-breasted, large-hipped, large-thighed woman sitting with her legs apart. And I was pretty amazed to find this in a church. I'm not entirely surprised that it's not there anymore, though. So there you go, and their project had a beginning and a middle and an end. And we're encouraged so much by loads of things, by insurance, by trying to get regular income, by loads of things. One of the things the system appears to be trying to do is establish a continuity through inheritance, through insurance, through all manner of things. when in fact all things start, go on for a bit, and then stop. And, you know, that this was a big project for everybody involved, and Linkro said it was like you're aware that you'd done 4 weeks and there were X weeks left and all of the rest of it, so you can see yourself using the experience up and you know you're going to move on from it. And I wonder whether this isn't a more natural way of approaching the things that happen to us, that education should be perhaps a matter of a series of experiences that we encounter, work with for a while, learn from, and then sort of move on to the next thing, instead of being constantly presented with the same old meat and veg day in, day out, like hamsters. So the beginning, the middle and the end, bit of release at the end as well. I think they were very chirpy about the whole thing. And an actual ferryman, I especially love the fact that they met an actual ferryman. And Synchro said, of course, it's totally transformational that for everybody involved. And they're out there now, which I think is really great. I'm going to return to a bit of any other business. I shall return to this Court of Permanent Record and endeavour to give you a brief introduction to what that's about. And also I'd like to revisit briefly the subject of badgers, which is something we were talking about in the first Dr. Rocks radio show. But I've got some good news about the badgers, which is really great. It's lovely to be able to bring people some good news. But in the meantime, the Awakening Albion people are out there tonight. They will be meeting up and they will be preparing to sing and dance and chat their way across the country. So you're listening to Dr. Rock's radio show on tnsradio.com. This is Nick M. We've been listening to a bit about Awakening Albion, the walk, but now I'd like to talk just a little bit briefly about the Court of Record. I was hoping to have Jonathan Adams on earlier in the show, but the technology turned out to be not quite up to it, and it's also possible that we'll be able to get somebody from White Rabbit perhaps to come on and talk with us as well, which would be really great. I'm hoping that we are going to be able to put that together sometime in the next few days, you know, or whenever, but we will be able to talk about this because it's quite an interesting idea. Many have found the email they've set out says many have found that when dealing with those masquerading as corporate fictions, no means yes, when really no means no. So how many times must we say no consent? In light of recent events across the aisle, White Rabbit proposes to launch our own transparent online Court of Record, which has authority to run alongside any cases, review past cases and handle future cases. Law form will be truth. The modus operandi will be that the site will be hosted securely, because we obviously don't want to, you know, have it taken down. The site will contain total transparency. Only fully sworn affidavits may be submitted for consideration as evidence, either with unlimited commercial liability or under penalty of perjury. However, all those submitting cases will post-scan all documents sent and or received in any given matter for scrutiny by the people. Addresses of Bevlin may remain anonymous. However, details of all those acting or attempting to act in public office or via the public to cause harm to a man or woman will be shown in full. The main screen will contain the court rules and access to law resources. There will be an ability for members to self-elect for any given case as jurors and to cast a decision on any given case. Decisions of the court can be downloaded with digital signatures proposed to case judgment. They won't be able to ignore 23 or more votes. Notices will be sent to all major legal bodies and local courts to make them aware of our existence due to their inadequacies and a loss of faith in them to control criminality and misrepresentation among their judges and staff. So this is an interesting idea, I think, because really it's what we're experiencing again and again, is that we can send in our affidavits, and as we've said before on this program, and I know that I've heard it a lot on TNS, what just comes back is a different shaped form which says you know, give us the money. And we wonder why it is that we're doing all of these things sometimes. Well, doing it this way, we can actually put it in front of another sort of court. We can put all of the documents that we work so hard to place before the corporate courts to try and get some sort of effect, and put them in front of another court, and then see how one system perhaps differs from the other, or how they're same, and use one to feed into the other. So there's a thoroughly interesting idea that's coming from White Rabbit. I think it's obviously, it would become fairly rapidly a huge resource for us as well. There could be lots of things there for us to think about. So hopefully we'll be able to get some conversation going on that. Clearly it looks to me like it's a fairly fairly well advanced project. People have obviously put quite a lot of thought and resource into it. So I certainly look forward to hearing more about it, and if I do, of course, I'll endeavour to bring it to you. A subject that's been quite close to the Dr. Rock radio show since the beginning is the subject of badgers and the potential cull of badgers over in West Wales. And there was considerable pressure to, there has been for some time, because there's a lot of trouble with tuberculosis and because there's a lot of badgers and a lot of cows. It's thought that if we get rid of a lot of badgers, then we might be able to get rid of the tuberculosis. And there's been quite a lot of people going around trying to find their way onto land and have a look for badger sets so that, you know, gather information for any future cull. And the first programme we had Keith and Helen from Truth Juice West Wales on, telling us that there appeared to be some kind of administrative attempt to kind of override a legal or judicial decision that had been made to kind of hold off culling badgers for all manner of reasons, actually, which are quite evident to all, I think. But somebody had decided that it was going to go ahead with the cull anyway. Well, the good news is from Helen that proposal has now at least been held in abeyance. And I'm pretty relieved about that. I would imagine, obviously, that there will be more manoeuvres and things, and that things are going to go through the courts and what have you. And I will eventually talk to Helen and Keith about it, I'm sure, on the programme. But I had a quick look at the government's approach to tackling the disease and the consultation on badger control policy, and it's really quite incredible, really. It says that the government's proposal is to issue licences under the Protection of Badgers Act 1992 to enable farmers and landowners to cull badgers. The government's proposal is to issue licences under the Protection of Badgers Act 1992 to enable farmers and landowners to cull badgers. Amazing. At their own expense, and subject to strict license criteria. Under existing arrangements, farmers and landowners are already able to apply for license to vaccinate badgers. Under the new proposal, they'll be able to use vaccination either on its own or in combination with culling. This approach will empower farmers to take control of reducing the risks of transmission from the wildlife reservoir at the local level. Well, in order to obtain a license to cull badgers, applicants will be expected to satisfy a series of criteria to ensure that the cull is justified and is likely to contribute to controlling bovine TB in cattle in their area. It's expected there'll be a single license application for each culling area of at least 150 kilometres squared. The application will need to meet strict license criteria set out in section 4 of this consultation document. I'll try and make this available to people, a link to this, because it's a really fascinating document. Farmers and landowners will be expected to cover the costs of culling and or vaccination themselves. They're not having an easy time of it, farmers, you know. They haven't actually got a lot of money at all. Government will put in place arrangements to issue licences in response to application meeting the criteria. And will take responsibility for monitoring the effectiveness, humaneness and impact of badger control measures. Yeah, right. Where appropriate, the use of vaccination will be encouraged to mitigate against the negative effects of culling brought about by perturbation. That says, where appropriate, the use of vaccination will be encouraged to mitigate against the negative effects of culling brought about by perturbation. So they seem to be thinking there might be some negative effects themselves here. Farmers and landowners will be able to apply for licences individually or collectively to vaccinate badgers as part of an approach coordinating locally with culling activity. This will allow them to cage, trap and vaccinate badgers within an area specified by the licence. Well, some of this just doesn't seem to make a lot of sense, does it? So you are just really happy to think that they really perhaps back. And this has been the story of the badger cull, is that there's been lots of attempts to do it, and it keeps going backwards. And these papers are really amazing thing. It says badgers typically live in social groups of 4 to 7 animals with defined territorial boundaries. Culling disrupts the organisation of social groups, which causing survivors' badgers to range more widely. I've put that in there because that's what we know to be true. But It says badgers are known, this is, it says in there, in the actual report, badgers are known to maintain the disease and thus serve as a potential cause of disease outbreaks in kept animals and act as a reservoir of the infection in parts of England. But you could even, you could just change badgers and cattle around there, and you could say cattle are known to maintain the disease and thus serve as a potential cause for disease outbreaks in wild animals and act as a reservoir of the infection in parts of England. Those two statements are more or less kind of, you can't really prove one of them over the other, given the science, and perhaps that's another reason why the foot's being taken off the loud pedal. Obviously there is a problem there, and the problem of TB in domesticated cattle is definitely causing a whole lot of grief, and quite a lot of it appears to be unnecessary, and that a lot of animals are being constantly tested but not, you know, reacting. And then there's the kind of weight and everything, but it seems clear that even in the proposal for, even just the beginning of this proposal on what they're going to do, it seems to admit within itself that there are going to be negative effects. And as we pointed before, there's got to be, under those basis, on that basis, we have to assume that there's at least an evens possibility that, that you're going to make the problem worse rather than better. You know, people out there cage trapping and shooting badgers and what have you. It would be very hard for me to witness that sort of thing, I think. It would certainly be very hard for me to go out and execute it. There you go, doesn't sound like it's happening in the immediate future, so that's a good thing. I'll be keeping an eye on that, see what happens in the future. One more thing that I'd like to mention before I shuffle off the airwaves is that there's a general move on TNS, and certainly from the Scottish sovereigns on the land, to organise a form of protest, if you like, because we've obviously, as enthusiastically non-compliant and people, we have been wondering for some time what it is we can do. There's a general feeling, I think, that it's not always a good idea to put ourselves on the street and put ourselves in harm's way necessarily for the things that we believe, because we tend to, it's easier for us to be rounded up, and all manner of things can happen to us when we do that. And obviously we've found various ways of making things slightly more expensive and slightly more time consuming, and I think we're finding new ways of doing that all the time. But I think the feeling's been that it really, from my own point of view, I feel that if you get 1 million or 2 million people actually on the streets, then ideally somebody somewhere should take a little bit of notice, perhaps. And the real problem is that I think that as obviously, if you know 2 million people or what have you, is not enough, then obviously other methods have to be sought. I gather from talking to friends that there's starting to be various strikes amongst an increasingly discontented populace. Many of us, again, rather like there's no point in going out on the streets, many of us as self-employed or individual people or free men or what have you, we don't really have the option of striking either, partly because I don't suppose anybody would notice if I went on strike, and we're not kind of a big block of people. So what to do was the idea, and I think this very creative idea has come about of a non-compliance week. There's a fair bit of notice on it. It does seem to be, so I know that some people have said that it seems to be quite a long way away, because we're aiming at September the 12th to the 18th, I think, are the official dates. And the idea is to gather as much stuff as you need to be at home during those days with your family or whoever it is that lives about you, to get the food in and get all the things that you need to, you know, have some time with family and friends, and try and buy that stuff from local co-ops or from local shops rather than from big corporations. I guess and it's up to individuals, I guess, how far you take it, but I guess the idea is not to travel, not to use fuel. And I think one of the things that would happen about that, I mean, perhaps to start with, there won't be too many people. Who knows how many people will be listening by September? We might have gone viral by then. But whatever, the people who do try it are going to experience something that they haven't experienced probably for quite a long time, this kind of degree of personal freedom and comfort at home. And that was one of the messages of the Awakening Albion Walk, was that the 50 days out on the road really changed people. I did a similar thing myself. I had what was for me a massive expedition, first 14-day holiday of my life, when I rode a motorcycle over to Eastern Europe as it was then, and back again. And again, it completely transformed me, and that was really an 11-day trip. So quite apart from the economic effect or whatever else we might be hoping to achieve, just spending a little bit of time on your own or with your family or with your friends doing the things that you want to do at home, at the end of those 7 days, you won't be the same person as you were at the beginning. That's all I can say. Well, we've got Yoda and Daryl coming up on the Financial Frontline, which is one of my favourite programmes, so I shall be seeking to get myself off the airwaves and crack a beer pretty soon. I'm going to leave you with a little bit of a poem that was written, and it was called Albion, after the Awakening Albion Walkers. They made a really beautiful book called Awakening Albion, From Cornwall to East Anglia, Walking Together as a Mindful Community, and it's got beautiful pictures, lots of little bits of diary entry, and of course it goes right across the country. They've even, somebody's drawn little pencil drawings of the entire route along the bottom of the pages. It's ever such a gorgeous thing. And one of the things they've got at the front of it is this Albion, the Wounded Being We Inhabit poem, which Synchro and I just, it's only tiny, did a bit of reading from, so I'll leave you with that and a bit of a closing tune. And then it'll be time for the Financial Frontline. Next week, who knows, perhaps we'll be having a talk about this new court idea. Or we might be listening to a man simply known as Pete and how it was that he spent a couple of hours recently in a magistrate's court arguing the toss over council tax. So I should think it'll be one or other of those things, but I won't be able to decide which until I get close to the time. Until then, well, thank you all very much for listening. It's been a pleasure to be here as always. Thank you very much for TNSR, Land of the Free, for hosting me. And I'll see you all again soon. Cheers, folks.
Albion.
The giant's flesh became the soil.
The giant's bones became rocks and stones.
The giant's blood became the springs and streams and lakes and the blue waters of the wide sea.
The dome of the giant's skull became the great dome of the sky that stretches high above our heads.
The giant's brains became the white scudding clouds.
One eye became the sun, the other the moon.
The giant's breath became the wind that lifts the hair from our foreheads.
And we, the people, treading the skin of the world beneath the vast dome of the sky, we are its dreams.
Some say the wounded sleeping being we inhabit is called Albion.
It is the grandfather of all the grandfathers, the grandmother of all the grandmothers.
We are its dreaming, and its skin holds the memory of all that it has dreamed in the past.
Adapted by storyteller Hugh Lupton from the 12th century Icelandic prose Edda by Snorri Sturluson.